Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, more questions after Ambassador Nathi Mtetwa's mysterious death in Paris. A new report questions big profits in private healthcare. The now lapsed AGOA deadline adds more pressure on South African trade, and the tenuous relationship between poor policy execution and investment in South Africa. It's Wednesday, the 1st of October. Now, there's compelling new research from Open Secrets, which has laid bare how a handful of medical scheme administrators and private hospital groups are continuing to dominate South Africa's private healthcare sector, raking in high profit while regulatory warnings go unheeded. I'd like to discuss this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Zen Mate, investigator at Open Secrets, co-author of the report, Who Owns South Africa Private Healthcare. Zen, a very warm welcome. So how do these profit margins and dominance affect average South Africans' access and costs, I wonder?
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be having this conversation this afternoon. For us, having a look at who owns South Africa's private healthcare sector, you know, we bring to the forefront of a really important conversation that focuses on healthcare and the issues in South Africa's healthcare system. And we say that there are many of them, and there are many systemic problems across, from corruption, staffing shortfalls, medicine stockouts, infrastructure deficits, inequality and access, poor wait times and poor health outcomes. And there is no doubt it remains important for urgent action, I think, to be taken to address these issues that plague the country's public healthcare sector system. However, often overlooked, we put forward are some of the key factors in the private healthcare system that distort also the broader healthcare system and push up costs for consumers and profits for corporations. And I think for us, just spotlighting the private hospitals in the country and the private medical schemes, we found that, you know, there's only three, Life, Mediclinic and Medcare, and on the other side, Discovery, Bonitas and Momentum. And they control more than 80% of the private healthcare market in the country. And, over the past 10 years, our research has shown and stands, I think, in concert with previous work done by the Competition Commission, that over the past 10 years, in the prices in the private healthcare sector have increased at approximately double the rate of consumer inflation. And I think even now, only less than 20% of the population are members of medical aid schemes. And on average, you have a standard medical aid scheme costing price that's around 1,500 Rand at minimum or more. Mm. And in a country with such stark inequality, where prices and household food baskets and just minimum wages and real wages have continued to decrease, and the World Bank has even found the country to be the most unequal in the world, in a country in that context, rising medical costs and unaffordable healthcare that has continued to be rampant over the years is a grave injustice for the public.
You suggest that watchdog warnings have been ignored. Which regulatory bodies are you referring to in the report, and what specifically did they warn about?
And I think thank you for that. And we specifically referred to the work and the findings of the Competition Commission, which concluded, I think it was in September, about in 2019. And the final findings and recommendations of the Health Market Inquiry at this time was examining the competition, or lack thereof, rather, to speak, in South Africa's private healthcare sector, and looked specifically at Life Healthcare, Mediclinic, and Netcare. And it was prompted by concerns some years ago about high prices in the private healthcare sector. And when that work concluded, it did happen over some time, it concluded and found that there were high levels of concentration in the private hospital groups and the medical schemes. And that has been part of why costs have been driven above inflation, and caused not only rising input costs, but also the absence of competition and poor oversight. And I think you've asked what some of the findings have been, was that the private healthcare sector in the country has been driven by profit rather than patient needs. And arguments were made even back then, some years ago now, after those findings in 2019, that costs will continue to rise unchecked without regulatory reform. And I think one of the other things that was flagged by the Competition Commission's finding was that there is cross ownership and structural conflicts of interest in the sector. So and this was flagged as problematic because, of course, if there's cross ownership, and I'll speak to this a little bit more, there is essentially conflicts of interest, and conflicts of interests can arise. And what we have found following on from that is that this is not only was true back then, but continues to be true now. Mapping ownership across the sector, the private healthcare sector, we see that, for example, Remgro, which is a South African company linked to the Ruperts, has significant shares in ownership in Mediclinic, and on the other hand, has significant shares in ownership in Discovery and Momentum. And so the issue there is that when you have ownerships where the same owners that are mapped across, the hospital groups, they could be pushing up a favorable contract, pricing structures, and network arrangements.
Aside from the cross ownership, does the investigation then identify any specific cases of either collusion, anti-competitive behavior, or plain abuse of market power?
Yeah, I think other than ownership, we speak in terms of that element, not necessarily finding particular elements of collusion, but rather the broader issue of what we find to be happening, which is the financialization of the healthcare sector and health in the country. And the issue that we map out there is that when you have a financialization that is made possible through the ownership structure, you have ownership of companies in the private healthcare sector that are investor-led, and shareholder dividends and payouts become the main concern, as opposed to essentially commodifying healthcare and changing the mission of health, which is usually associated with the value of providing this good, and to now this privatization and financialization, where we have now healthcare is commodified. And in our healthcare sector, we also find that a lot of the companies that do have ownership, aside from those within the country, are countries that are actually, there's about seven countries with significant ownership that are based outside of the country. So you have a financialization of the sector and a commodifying element of the healthcare sector in South Africa. But then you also have money going out of the country through dividend payouts to shareholders, to companies that are not even based in the country.
I'll need a quick answer. Does the report recommend any immediate reform or intervention?
Absolutely. I think one of the main things that we say is that we need to make concerted effort to regulate the private healthcare sector. And there are efforts in the pipeline to do that. And we need to engage around those. And we'll continue to push for efforts to do that.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Zen Mate, investigator at Open Secrets, co-author of the report, Who Owns South Africa Private Healthcare?
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you'll be well aware that South Africa's ambassador to France, Natie Mtetwa, has died in Paris, and reports this morning, quoting French prosecutors, say he sent a message to his wife before his death indicating that he intended to take his own life. It's now up to investigators in Paris to determine what happened, while DIRCO here in South Africa coordinates with French authorities and, I imagine, provides support to the family as well as diplomatic staff. Speaking for DIRCO is Crispin Peary, who joins me on the program. So, Crispin, a very warm welcome. What happens next in terms of the investigation in Paris? Have any further details emerged overnight?
No details have emerged thus far. We are awaiting confirmation from the French authorities. There's been a number of reportage around what has happened, but at this stage, we are entirely in the hands of the French authorities to really understand what the full facts are.
At this stage, though, you would hope to be working closely with French authorities, for instance, being given access to preliminary findings by the investigators in Paris. Again, still early days, I imagine.
It would have to also be via the family. So, you know, it's a matter of also coordinating all of this with the family. The first point of call of the people who would receive this information is the family, and then the department second. But yes, our French mission, our French embassy is hand in glove with the French authorities, and they're also working with the family.
At this stage, is there any conversation or talk about South Africa sending investigators to France?
No, not at this stage. Jeremy, your listeners may know this, but it's worth reminding South Africans that generally ambassadors are protected under the Vienna Convention. So there are a number of immunities that they would be privy to, but that also means that the state, the host state, has certain obligations. And in that regard, we would be in the hands of the French authorities. And I think so far we are satisfied that they are fulfilling all of their obligations insofar as the diplomatic protocols are concerned around such matters.
I understand this is a sensitive issue, but at this point, are you able to tell me whether DIRCO has any direct contact with the ambassador's family and how they're being supported?
Yes, we have constant contact with the ambassador's family, both from Pretoria and currently in Paris. Our second in charge, the Charge d'Affaires, is at the residence quite frequently and is often engaging with the late ambassador's wife, as is the head office here in Pretoria. So support that we just intend to support, is obviously psychotherapy at some point. The colleagues are traumatized by this experience, and so the department will provide the relevant therapeutic services.
I do understand that. And again, my next question is leading on from that. And again, without jumping the gun in terms of cause of death or what might have happened, generally, what kind of psychological or mental health support would DIRCO provide diplomats serving abroad?
Definitely therapeutic services, but it depends on the issue at hand. But we do have the ability to ensure that whatever form of therapy or in maybe rehabilitation, anything that would ensure that our officials abroad are then able to recover and ultimately fulfill the service to the nation, we would ensure that they have that level of support.
Are there plans to review those support systems in light of this tragedy?
Well, we don't know what is the underlying cause of this tragedy. It could be personal matters. It could be, we don't know exactly also what the cause of death is. So I think we wouldn't land there yet. But of course, there's always attempts to ensure that our officials abroad have the best possible service so that they can fly the flag.
Could you explain to me how the embassy in Paris right now is managing day-to-day operations while dealing with the loss of its head?
At this point, the mission is closed for official business. It will probably be closed just for the next 2 days. But we do understand that if there's anything urgent that a South African requires, our mission website and services are up and running. You are able to reach the officials at the mission, but albeit under a bit slower circumstances than normal.
Is there any clarity on what Ambassador Mtetwa's last official communication with DIRCO was?
No, not with DIRCO. Not with DIRCO. We don't have any direct information. It would be probably with the colleagues at the mission. That's also information that they would probably hand over to investigators at this stage. But there was no official communication necessarily with Pretoria in the last couple of days.
There's been a lot of reporting in South Africa about a link between his death and his being named in the ongoing Madlanga Commission of Inquiry. Does Dirka have a view on that?
To say this, firstly, that a commission really is focusing on the state of policing. This is a former minister of police. So naturally, such a name like that would come up. But we would urge South Africans not to speculate. We can only take a view around what is being said at any commission once the report has been filed and once everyone has been given an opportunity to present their side of the coin, so to speak. So I think that would be at best speculative and premature to speculate anything untoward.
And just a final question on the French investigation itself. Once that is concluded, what can South Africans expect in terms of an official update? I guess I'm asking you about the timeline of this investigation, which would be urgent, surely.
It is urgent, given the fact that the French authorities have to pronounce on the cause of death. That then triggers the repatriation processes, depending on what the cause of death was. If it's natural, it's a lot more easier. If it's unnatural, of course, then a number of other protocols in terms of French law would have to kick in. But if they are able to determine what the cause of death is, we then will be communicating with the family to understand when they would like to have the burial services and all of that. And then from there, the repatriation kicks in.
Crispin Piri speaks for the Department of International Relations and Cooperation.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
This week is the deadline for South Africa's access to the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA as we know it, and uncertainty around the outcome has sent policy confidence plunging to its lowest level in nearly a decade. Relations between Pretoria and Washington have become increasingly strained, raising the risk that South African exporters could lose preferential access to the United States market. I want to assess what is at stake and what comes next, but I also want to talk more broadly about the latest policy uncertainty index, and in that respect I'm joined by Professor Raymond Parsons, a respected economist at Northwest University. Raymond, before we talk about policy uncertainty, let's reference AGOA if we can. It's an important week. What are the most immediate risks that we face now that the deadline has arrived?
Well, I think, Jeremy, that the most important risks in a way are not unexpected, because the situation has been looming up for some time under three main headings. The first is, of course, that there is in place the 30% tariff hikes from the US on South Africa. We've then also got the expiry of the AGOA agreement today, with some uncertainty, of course, as to whether it will be renewed, and if so, in what shape or form. And thirdly, of course, although a new trade agreement between South Africa and the US is pending, it hasn't happened yet, so that does prolong the time of uncertainty. So for some of our export sectors like agriculture and the motor industry, this is a very unsettling period, because they don't quite know where these various chips will now fall and how this will affect their trade and their investment decisions. And of course, the biggest enemy of those decisions is uncertainty. So the sooner these matters can be resolved, obviously from an external point of view, the better, particularly as in the first place, the US remains a very important market for us. But secondly, in exploring alternatives, and the president has emphasized more than once, diversification is now the name of the game. That takes time. And for that, we will have to be globally competitive. And the cost of doing business in South Africa will have to be minimized. So there's a big challenge while the uncertainty is still prevailing and while our plans are still being formulated.
In fact, Professor Parsons, your report, or the report by the Northwest University's Business School, has found that policy uncertainty has surged to its highest level since 2016 in the 3 months ending September. Why is that, and how concerned should we be?
Well, I think there are two converging factors. We've already dealt with some of these global uncertainties and the US uncertainties and our relationship with a key market. That's the one segment that has contributed. But of course, there have also been the domestic factors that have raised this level of uncertainty, not because there weren't positive factors. As the report indicates, if we look back over the past few months, there have been some very positive developments. Higher GDP growth, we're seeing an economic recovery, however weak, underway. We've had lower inflation, lower interest rates. The Eskom load shedding has now come to an end. Unfortunately, in the past 3 months, the external negative factors combined with some of the continued well-known issues that we know, that the Eskom tariffs have gone up, the issue of crime, and all these issues are still with us. And so the net outback, the net impact in the past quarter was to now bring that index to its highest level. But what has gone up can also come down. And so the issue really is, what remedies and what policies are we going to follow so that we can bring that index down, get the growth and investment to the level we want, and be able to address in particular our unemployment problem, for which we need much higher growth and investment over the years ahead.
Professor, what type of reframing then would assist in right-sizing the policy index?
I think it's both on the economic front, where clearly some of the reform policies, although they are showing some success, need, because of the external threats over which we do not have that much control, however well we will negotiate and work within our parameters with the US and with other trading blocs, it also says to us that these are not issues over which we have direct control as a small open economy. What we do control are the factors that affect internal policy uncertainty, and where we can promote certainty by expediting and implementing the reforms that we've undertaken, which we need to show much more visible results on the delivery front. We've got the mini budget coming up next month. In that case, one doesn't want a rerun of the whole political saga that we saw with the main budget. So we've got to reduce the level of policy uncertainty by getting more things right the first time round and building investor confidence, and thus also the growth rate and the growth prospects that both from an economic and a political point of view, you want to see more firms next year being willing to undertake expansion plans on the investment front. That's the ultimate key to getting the incipient economic recovery to a much higher and sustained level over the next couple of years.
And how should business leaders, Professor, factor this uncertainty index into their strategic planning? Or is it more just a reflection of short-term noise?
What they really want is, they really want for South Africa to, both from an external and an internal point of view, get to a point where you can say with a degree of confidence that there's a clear and predictable policy environment in South Africa that enables business to take a long-term perspective on growth and development. That's what you want. But for that, you want to obviate short-term noise by simply saying there is a longer-term prospect that creates an environment that will promote investment and growth. And for that, you will also need to inspire confidence, not only among business people, but through your cooperation between government, labor, and business. Say, we are going to build on the incipient recovery and make it sustainable. And for that, you need a much clearer and predictable policy environment than we are enjoying at the moment.
Professor Raymond Parsons from the Northwest University Business School, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA as we know it, comes to an end after 25 years, if I'm not mistaken, of shaping trade between the US and sub-Saharan Africa. Now, this agreement has been a cornerstone of US foreign policy on the continent, offering duty-free access to American markets and supporting manufacturing jobs in countries like ours and also Lesotho. But with no clear word from Washington on renewal, the future of this lifeline is obviously in serious doubt. Now, there are some reports suggesting a one-year extension may still be on the cards under something called an America First framework, but nothing has been confirmed. So I want to understand what is at stake for both African economies and for US influence in the region. And I am joined by trade expert Donald McKay. He's been on the program before, of XA Global Trade Advisors. Donald, what does it mean in practical terms if AGOA expires today or this week?
Well, it would have meant a lot more before the world was introduced to the idea of Liberation Day tariffs. So what happens now is the net effect, or the net value that we obtain out of AGOA in South Africa, is on average about 3.5%. And we've got a 30% additional tariff on top of everything. So to be honest with you, losing the 3.5% is just, it's going to be swallowed up in the 30%. The effect, however, on other African states is far worse. So countries like Lesotho, for example, who export almost exclusively textiles to the US, will be very hard hit. And their benefit was far greater than ours. So we have no benefit for textiles, but Lesotho does. And so they've gone from about a 16.5% advantage to now having to pay that if this does disappear, plus a 15% on top. So for South Africa, not that big. For the rest of Africa, more significant.
Good news as far as South Africa is concerned, but we've seen very disturbing reports as far as Lesotho goes. But if AGOA lapses, have you quantified how many actual jobs in South Africa we are realistically talking about losing? Have you done that calculation?
Well, no, but here's what I can say. It's an impossible calculation to do because AGOA is so drastically overshadowed by the 30%. So whatever jobs are going to be lost are going to be lost because of the very large reciprocal tariffs rather than AGOA. But if we kind of go back to the sectors that are most impacted, your single biggest sector is automotive. And there were really two car producers which were sending cars in at scale. So certainly those two would face the highest risk. I would guess all in, if we were just losing AGOA, we'd maybe look at 10 to 15,000 jobs. I don't think the 100,000 in the media was correct.
And Donald, conceptually, there is the argument that AGOA has become a little outdated, perhaps. Do African economies maybe need a different kind of trade approach or different kind of trade deal right now in 2025, when the paradigm, as you pointed out, has shifted completely?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, I would argue that the whole world is faced with the dilemma that the US is now an incredibly unreliable trading partner. And so, you know, what we've learned probably more than anything else is that you have to diversify the markets that you send your product to so that no single country can hold you to ransom in the way that the US has done. I think, you know, AGOA, it was nice to have, but it was never a trade agreement. It never offered huge benefits to anybody. Some small countries perhaps exempted from that statement. But, you know, what we are looking for is more dependable preferential access. And of course, we want to be just better competitive producers. You know, most of Africa is not good at making almost anything, including South Africa. Mm. And, you know, we've got to fix those problems. And then I think we'd have much better opportunities abroad.
And Donald McKay, tell me this, reverse risk. How big a blow might this be to the United States and its influence in Africa, particularly with China waiting in the wings?
Yeah, I mean, that's a far bigger issue. I think the United States has simply walked away from all of its soft power globally. And that's a problem that is going to take decades to fix. Yeah, I think they have simply ceded Africa from a soft power perspective to China. I don't really see how they get that position back again.
So now the Trump administration is hinting at something called an America First 1-year extension. What do you know about that, and what might that look like in practice?
Yeah, so I have no idea what that means, which is true for many things that President Trump says. I don't know what that means. The point, AGOA was a rounding error in the U.S.'s life. It was essentially not a cost to them to give away these concessions. So I'm not sure what he is looking for. If he is looking for African countries to buy a lot more product from the U.S., these are tiny economies with a small ability to purchase a lot. So, the view has always been better access for U.S. products. I'm not sure what Africa can offer American producers that would be enticing.
So right now, then, how should South Africa, and for that matter, its neighbors, be quickly repositioning themselves?
Yeah, so there isn't anything we can do in the very short term, but in the medium to long term, we absolutely have to diversify the markets that we export to. That's not an easy problem to solve, but it is a critical problem to solve. The U.S. is a big economy. They account for 25% of the world's GDP, but they only account for 17% of the world's trade. The other 83% is where the whole world has got to focus on. And I think President Trump has done a great job to get the rest of the world looking at how they can better trade with each other.
So if you're talking about the diversification of markets, then does Africa do this in unison, or is it up to every country to do it on their own?
Well, the good news is by starting the conversation on the AFCFTA, we've created a forum where African states can interact with each other. So I think that's good. It would be good for this to be coordinated. But the reality is there are four countries in the whole of Africa which make up 50% of Africa's GDP. And it's those four countries that really will determine the fate of much of Africa. Will these countries, of course, South Africa being one of the largest, will we open our markets to the rest of Africa? Will we have those kind of honest conversations? If we do, that would be powerful. If Africa can really move faster, getting infrastructure built so that we can be more competitive, that would be good. But this is a difficult problem. If Africa can operate as a unit, we have far more negotiating power than each country operating on its own.
Donald McKay from XA Global Trade Advisors, I do appreciate your time and your insight. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.